I think we are met, and it's great to, thanks for coming out on a rainy day in this deluge supernatural. Today I'd love to talk about punctuation. I've been talking with some Old Testament scholars and New Testament scholars, and they were telling me that Hebrew didn't, in the texts that were written of that we have, would have been in all caps. There was no lowercase. There was no spacing, and there were no vowels. And so it was really just a cheat sheet for stories they already knew to kind of recapitulate them and hopefully embody them again. And the same with Greek. There was it was in all caps, and there was no punctuation in either of them. No punctuation. And I think I've been talking for this week about the kind of the text being the ultimate arbiter, and that the kind of sacrosanct text. You can't mess with the text. And of course, you know, all rules are meant to be broken, but I still do hold to the text being pretty steadfast, a great, full of clues for us. But one place that I do think we can find our license is in the punctuation, is in how we decide to manage the thoughts. Because really, we were talking about Hamlet as a great codifying of thought, that he embodies, and is that distracting people a little bit?
Not a bit.
Yeah. Dropping this, the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. If it gets too bad, we'll let me know. But so punctuation as a place to have license as an actor. How do I want to frame my thoughts? How am I going to make them move? And how am I going to craft them and come up with an interpretation? And so I'd love to start with this bit of the the Scottish king from Macbeth, and the circumstances are that he's been told by these weird sisters that he's going to be the Thane of Cawdor, which is something the Thane of Glamis, which is the title he already possesses. But then the next witch tells him he's going to be the Thane of Cawdor, which makes no sense because the person is still alive. And then that he's going to be king. And he takes this away thinking, well, who knows. But no sooner do the witches leave, but someone comes and tells him that, actually, Thane of Cawdor has been killed, and you've been named the new Thane of Cawdor. So this sort of sets something in motion in his mind. He writes back to his wife, says, I've been told this thing. I need to talk with you about it. The wife gets the letter. Lady Macbeth gets pretty excited about this. A messenger comes in, tells her that the king is coming to stay with them tonight. So everything is unfolding in favor of, if you're a fan of regicide, everything is unfolding perfectly. Couldn't be better. And so initially, Lady Macbeth convinces her husband, we need to kill him, this is the time. He's left alone, and now he's having a moment of what I like to call scorpion mind, because he has this line later where he says, how full of scorpions is my mind, dear wife. And I think it says something to how he thinks and how he goes through these processes. But I've obviously eliminated all the punctuation. I'd love to go through it and punctuate it and see if we can come up with two kind of alternative options that would, as an actor, be viable in either way. But so things to know, it's fascinating that Macbeth can't say the word murder. So just look for the words he uses instead of murder, as he's contemplating. And jump, in this sense, jumping the life to come is like risky, is the sense of jump there. And this is the very first use of assassination in the English language. So couldn't bring himself to say murder, so we better invent a word that will come to mean a kind of that. So first one, let's say, if it were done when 'tis done, then 'twere well. If it were done quickly, if the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease success. That but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all. Here. But here, upon this bank and shoal of time, we jump the life to come. Okay, so that's, you could say that's playable. And then somewhat resolute with a period at the end. And but there's an entirely different way, I'd argue, to take this that would go something like, if it were done when 'tis done, then 'twere well it were done quickly. If the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all here. But here, upon this bank and shoal of time, we jump the life to come. It's sort of a different way to access the scorpion pattern, the foot pattern of the scorpions in his mind. Any thoughts on this so far? The idea, for everybody who came in late, brought up the idea that was trying to draw the connection between sacred texts, like the Old Testament and the New Testament, that originally were written without punctuation. And then that required, in an oral culture, people to understand the story. And now for us, in a very literate and visual culture, we need to really return to that. And in some cases, I think, give ourselves the license to start again. Because also Shakespeare, in his oral culture, had no interest in or at least had no effect on the production of the manuscripts of his plays. He oversaw none of the quartos or folios of his plays that were ever produced. So that's the idea we're playing with, and we've just approached Macbeth from a couple different.
What about breathing?
Mm.
Because that one middle sentence is really long, and wouldn't you need some, I don't know, comments in there, something to help you know when to take breath, or is that really something you rehearse as an actor?
Really is. I mean,
yeah.
So I went to an actor training program, and we spent the first semester of voice class breathing out of our feet, breathing out of our, anus, breathing out, trying to find every way from which we could draw breath, and to sort of the simplest thing, we rolled around and took touches of sound, they were called. We were trying to make the most basic production of sound that is linked to breath, that you're starting with your breath. And so yes, definitely, we're talking about thought being non-punctuated. You can't really punctuate thought because it's always intersecting itself, in real life at least, and hopefully in Shakespeare too. But yes, I think it has to be connected to your voice. And you have to be really gifted, really nimble, really dexterous. It's like jazz, or I don't know that much about jazz. I know, as in I've never played it, but that you need to be always available and listening really closely to how your audience is responding. Did they follow that? Are they with me? Do they, do I need to speed up? Am I actually just moving too slowly? Am I moving too fast? And it can get really finessed in terms of what you're receiving from your fellow actors and audience, so that breath needs to be always available for another thought that might just keep going even farther than you thought it might in the first place, but you still have to sort of maintain enough in your system to finish. And that's kind of the rhythm of Shakespeare's thoughts, if you except that second reading. But yeah, breathing, I think, is huge.
Every audience is different.
And if you try and think that every show is the same, you're deluding yourself, because every audience that's coming to see it is seeing it completely different. So I'd love to do an exercise with the village here, similar to this. I'm going to hand you a sheet of paper, and this side needs to be up. It's a two-sided sheet. Looks like this, but you can't look at that side yet. because beneath it is an unpunctuated passage that I want to pass around the room. And anybody who wants to is free to flip it over and for as long as they can make sense of it. And as soon as it starts getting kind of gobbledygook, then just stop. You know, don't feel self-conscious. It just so happens that this speech I'm going to share with you is Richard III's nightmare speech, having just woken up from a nightmare in which all of the people he's killed, which is a lot, have come to him and told him that the next day of the huge battle, they're going to be fighting against him. So there's a huge amount of terror, and I think the language reflects that. And so it's, but yet I think there is some, we'll discover that there is some sway, some elasticity in it. So everybody that want to pass these around, remember, don't look at the top that says, that has all the numbers on it. Don't flip it over yet. And if you want to share, we might have to share. Sure. Yeah, let's, it seems like we'll probably, how many people do we have? Well, just the one side, actually, I think. Make 10 more. Yeah, who doesn't have them? So don't look at it yet. You can't look at it yet. Because the point is that we're going to try and compose it as we go. We're going to try and figure out the thought structure. So does everybody have a decent sense of the immediate circumstances? It's Richard III. He's waking up from an awful dream. And does everybody get the sense of the exercise that we're going to go as long as we can making sense of it? And as soon as we can't, as soon as it doesn't make sense, we'll stop. And the next person will have learned from what we've composed. And if it worked, they will build on it as a thought. Or they'll say, well, that was one thought. Now it's a new thought. And I'm going to build on it. And I want to see if we can slowly compose Richard's inner monologue. So does anybody want to start? So and as soon as it stops making sense, we'll just stop.
All right. Is this the side we're looking
at? No, the one that has no punctuation. Okay. The one the single block of So you want the side with the numbers facing you. All right, wait, everybody, we've got our first volunteer, Richard.
Tell me when I can turn the sheet up.
You can go see.
Aha. Give me another horse, bind up my wounds. Have mercy, Jesus. Soft, I did but dream of coward conscience. How dost thou afflict me? The lights burn blue, it's now dead midnight.
No, you're supposed to make sense of it, which you are.
Okay.
But if you want to pass it along, did people follow what he was saying?
Yeah.
Did we have a sense? Yeah. Little pauses there. Well, the next person might want to land in those pauses and see what that does. But remember, you can't look at it until it's your turn to flip it over. So, otherwise, you'll be able to start figuring out what the pattern is. So it's. So if there is anybody that hasn't done that, it would be particularly useful.
All right. The lights burn blue.
Well, you can actually start from the beginning. Sorry.
Okay.
So build on.
Okay. Give me another horse. Bind up my wounds. Have mercy, Jesus. Soft I did but dream. O coward conscience, how dost thou afflict me? The lights burn blue. It is now dead midnight. Cold, fearful frost. Stand on my trembling flesh. What do I fear myself? There's none else.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I was going.
Oh, I was done.
Great. Yeah, so if anybody wants to build from there, feel free to flip and give us a taste of your quality. All right, we have one in the back.
Are we starting at the beginning?
Yeah, so building on what people, if you agree with their punctuation, you can change it, but.
Dost thou afflict me? The lights burn blue. It is now dead midnight. Cold,
Who talks like that? Anybody else want to try? All right, Martha, do you want to give it a try? Does one more person want to give it a try? People warming up John, you want to give it a try?
Give me another horse. Bind up my wounds. Have mercy, Jesu. Soft-bedded wet dream. O coward, conscience, how dost thou afflict me? The lights burn blue. It is now a bit inward. Cold, fearful drops stand on my trembling flesh. What do I fear? Myself? There's none else. By Richard, loves Richard. That is I. That is I. That's where it all
comes from. Yeah, everybody can take a
not supposed to turn it
a look at it.
Listen to what
there are when we think about these, I was talking about these texts that we have of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Trying to get back to originals, the argument is that the closest thing we have to Shakespeare's text is called the First Folio, and in Shakespeare's, it wasn't published until 7 years after Shakespeare's death. So he obviously wasn't as interested in publishing it as his fellow actors were. A couple of them published it for him posthumously, but while the company was still working, Shakespeare's company was at the Globe, and then later at Blackfriars, quartos were released, they were called. And so a folio was roughly like an encyclopedia. Shakespeare's plays are the first ever volume of plays. It was usually only for academic texts, things like encyclopedias, really, that would have been printed in folio. So it was a big deal that Shakespeare's texts were printed that way. Quite an honor, and it kind of cemented him in the position he still holds as a sort of great English playwright. But those quartos that were released, there are a few theories on how they were done. Very often Shakespeare's name wasn't even attached, but they were the quarto means that it was a full page folded in half twice to save on paper, and then printed on all those sides. And it was like what we would about the size of a paperback, and they were often bastardized from notes people took at the play when they went to see a play, or actors could have wanted to go do a production in the, in the country, tour a production, so they would print out scripts for people. But so the folio has a certain kind of punctuation, and people like to think that that's a really valid punctuation. And so what contemporary editors tend to do is they tend to present it as literature, something we read that has to make sense reading, not like somebody working out a thought that is interrupting, and then realizing what they were going to say. There are all these kind of anomalies that appear in Shakespeare, especially in the folio, that are usually ironed out by an editor, and then the number one tool of an editor in the case of Shakespeare is punctuation. That's how you can craft it. So a lot of people believe that the punctuation in the folio is the closest to what Shakespeare intended. So that the speech in the folio, if we trust the punctuation, would go, "Give me another horse, bind up my wounds, have mercy, Jesu. Soft, I did but dream. Oh, coward conscience, how dost thou afflict me? The lights burn blue, it is now dead midnight. Cold, fearful drops stand on my trembling flesh. What? Do I fear myself? There's none else by. Richard loves Richard. That is, I am I. Is there a murderer here? No. Yes, I am. Then fly. What? From myself? Great reason why. Lest I revenge. What? Myself upon myself? Alack. I love myself. Wherefore? For any good that I myself have done unto myself? Oh no. Alas, I rather hate myself. For hateful deeds committed by myself. I am a villain. Yet I lie. Fool, I am not. Fool, of thyself speak well. Fool, do not flatter. My conscience hath a thousand several tongues, and every tongue brings in a several tale, and every tale condemns me for a villain. And those, the words I chose to emphasize there, the tongue and tale, and tale and villain, are capitalized in the folio. There's another thing about the folio, that there are particular words that are capitalized, and that's seems to be a clue that those are particularly operative for the actor, that you should really, you know, they're often antithetical words that Shakespeare's sort of clanging against each other. But the here's the punctuation in, you know, the one that you find online. MIT Shakespeare has this resource for a whole bunch of free plays on, Shakespeare plays online, so it's kind of a basic, you know, contemporary offering. So it would go, give me another horse, bind up my wounds. Have mercy, Jesu. Soft. I did but dream. Oh, coward conscience, how dost thou afflict me? The lights burn blue. It is now dead midnight. Cold, fearful drops stand on my trembling flesh. What do I fear? Myself? There's none else by. Richard loves Richard. That is, I am I. Is there a murderer here? No. Yes, I am. Then fly. What? From myself? Great reason why. Lest I revenge. What? Myself upon myself? Alack. I love myself. Wherefore? For any good that I myself have done unto myself? Oh, no. Alas, I rather hate myself for hateful deeds committed by myself. And so just that there are certain choices you can make. Do those have any thoughts on those two after having heard it spoken and listened to the sense unfolding?
Mm-hmm. The other is, suspicious or
mm-hmm.
uncertain.
Yeah, and I think these are the finessings we need to do between suspicious and unsure. I mean, people might think those are very similar, but that's exactly the kind of texture we need to distinguish between. What? Do I fear myself? Or what do I fear? Myself? You know, I mean, these are quite different suggestions, and I think they can enrich our, you know, experience of Richard's thinking. Any other thoughts on that? Did it make any difference? Did some people think makes no difference what the punctuation is, that they still feel the same story?
It could also be, what do I fear? Myself, there's none else.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's thank you. Are there any, actually, let me ask, are there any other, looking at that, this is great, looking at it without punctuation, not having that enforced upon you, did anybody hear anything that still didn't make sense to them that they think they might have a better reading of? And in some ways, I think these texts are meant to keep revealing themselves to us. I think that's part of their genius, was that there is no way to nail down what Macbeth is saying, and if you were to paraphrase it, you know, you would be doing a kind of violence to it by containing it in some container. Yeah, Martha?
I mean, with the line, Richard loves Richard, that is I am I, you could play that as him kind of losing his train of thought. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Richard loves Richard,
That's great. Yeah. No. Yeah, no, I think that those are the kind of naturalistic intonations that an editor would go berserk about, because Shakespeare is a genius and he doesn't write incomplete sentences. Actually, he principally writes incomplete and run-on sentences, you know, for the most part. So that's a, yeah, Ricky.
And can't you also go, Richard loves Richard, that is I.
Yeah, that's a great question in there. Am I? You know, I just had this dream. I just saw a bunch of people I killed that are related to me, you know.
It sounds like he's super confused with who he is. I mean, I think of therefore I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he knows who he is.
I think that's exactly true. And I think the point that we are in the play, all of his supporters are leaving him very quickly. He's very alone in the world. And this is really, and it's, I think Shakespeare in some ways matured a lot from this, because this is some of the first real humanizing in most productions of Richard III that you get of him, where he's out of control. I mean, he's so much in control. This whole play, you know, he's plots have I laid, inductions dangerous by drunken prophecies, libels and dreams. You know, he's the one, he's the moving the pawns. But now, suddenly, exactly, he doesn't know who he is. And the text seems to support that or reveal it.
Well,
so, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what Martha said is sort of restated by this in the next line, no, yes, I, and, you know, I mean, it's the same sort of
exactly.
Language, really.
No. Yes, I am. You know, or how can I convince myself? Yeah. Hopefully language will help me, but for once, Richard's at a loss of very helpful words. Loquacious fellow. But I'd love to say a little more about the folio technique, because with this punctuation, and if anybody has any further thoughts as things. Yeah?
Did any of Shakespeare's manuscripts survive at all?
No, not his, you know, quill. Mm-hmm. None of that. And what we do know about Shakespeare's company and the manuscripts that he did create were that they were on rolls, which is where we get the term, what is your roll? They would have been rolls of parchment, and they only ever had your lines and three cue words, the three last words the person who spoke before you says when you need to jump in. So, well, we've mentioned this at an earlier session, but it's remarkable to think about the kind of listening that you have to cultivate in order to make that at all function. You know, they had very, very little rehearsal time for these plays. You know, they'd get one in the beginning of the week, and by the end of the week, it would be in rotation. And they had, you know, 60 plays going, you know, that they could draw from at any given time. You know, what are we going to do this week? Because it wasn't just Shakespeare's plays. It was also Marlowe's plays and Thomas Webster's plays and Ben Jonson, get a few in there, but and a bunch of really bad ones that don't survive. But I, as an exercise, I want to look at a scene, and it's the scene that's on the back of most of those who didn't get the copy. So
can we turn it over now?
You can turn it over. Well, that's the side you're supposed to be looking at the whole time, actually. No, it's totally. If people can share,
I have one. And
so this is a scene from.
Okay, sorry.
Okay. This is a scene from The Merchant of Venice. And what's happened? Does anybody know the story of The Merchant of Venice? Can anybody help me with the plot? So Antonio has a friend, young friend named Bassanio. He's in love with Portia, but he needs money in order to go there and try this coffin trick, and then, which is the lottery setup whereby Portia will hopefully find the ideal suitor. But Bassanio prevails upon Antonio to lend him money, but Antonio doesn't have any money. But he does have three ships that are about to arrive home, and within them is, you know, contained much more money than he would need to repay whoever, the person who is lending the money to him, would require. And so Antonio agrees to do this, so the only he goes to Shylock, the Jew, and he asks for this bond, and Shylock agrees, even though Antonio used to spit upon his Jewish gabardine in the market. And this is an intensely racist culture, but he agrees to take this bond, lend him this money, and, you know, in a merry sort, let the a pound of your flesh be counterweight. Again, you know, that if you don't return the bond, you have to give me a pound of your flesh. You know, what's that good for? But what happens is, in the meantime, Bassanio's friend Lorenzo falls in love with Shylock's daughter, Jessica. They elope. Jessica steals everything from her father in the process, goes off to Genoa in the process, spends all the money, most notably trading in Shylock's widow's ring for a monkey. And these details are brought back to as barbs against Shylock by the other Christians to say, you know, this is what happened to your daughter. But then, oops, Antonio's ships have all miscarried. Everything's lost. He has no money. Suddenly, Shylock, for the first time in his life as a Jew in this culture, is in the driver's seat. And he wants revenge. And he wants it bad. And this is the first scene after we get this information that we see Shylock. And there is a jailer who's escorting Antonio to jail. And there is a friend that we've seen before. They're usually called the Salads, Solanio and Solario. Because they're two guys and they're kind of interchangeable in some respects. But that's the scene we're in, and I'd love it if do we have a Solanio? Does anybody want to read Solanio? It's a quick, not too much commitment. All right, we got a Solanio. How about an Antonio? Also not too much to read. Great. Anna, and would you like to read Shylock? Great. Shylock has a little more to say. So, scene. Yeah. I'd love to. Yeah, if you've noticed, you have some weird spelled words and some. There aren't quite as many. You'll notice in this one, there are not that many peculiar punctuations, but there are some odd spellings, and a lot of them have to do just with the I's were J's and the U's were V's. So those are, if that trips you up. But sometimes you'll have a word like here with an extra E on the end. And that's something you can feel free to lean into a little stronger, if you know, or fool with an E at the end. Often when there are two words, yield, like that one at the bottom of Shylock's third speech. That these can also be indicative of how important, how operative the word is for the actor. Thanks. That's great. And notice that he's just called Jew, which is another harsh detail. But, so would we be ready to hear it?
Jailer, look to him. Tell not me of mercy. This is the fool that lends out his money gratis. Jailer, look to him.
Hear me yet, good Shylock.
I'll have my bond. Speak not against my bond. I have sworn an oath that I will have my bond. Thou calledst me a dog before thou hadst a cause. Since I'm a dog, beware my things. The Duke shall grant me justice. I do wonder, thou naughty jailer, that thou art so fond to come abroad with him at his request.
I pray thee, hear me speak.
I'll have my bond. I will not hear thee speak. I'll have my bond, and therefore speak no more. I'll not be made a soft and dull-eyed fool, to shake the head, relent, and sigh, and yield to Christian intercessors. Follow not. I'll have no speaking. I will have my bond.
It is the most impenetrable cure that ever kept with men.
And that's another, that's a funny spelling of cur.
Oh, cur.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be able to tell from the spelling. But so you have an extra R and an E at the end.
Oh, so referring to Shylock.
Referring to Shylock as a cur. And some other things I should say, so the lending out money gratis is the thing that, the only way Jews could make money is they had to get interest. It was the only way in the city they could make money. So it was But the Christians make that a very huge deal because they don't do that. They don't charge interest. They just lend their money. It was the culture then. So that's what when he says, when he points that at Antonio and says, "This is the fellow that lends out money gratis." So the jailer doesn't say much, and the Solano doesn't say much. Would the people who read it, would you mind standing up and coming up here and sort of staging it a little? Very basic kind of just to see. And we also at this point need a jailer. No speaking. You don't have to speak. We just need you as a body.
Bring my sword, but I will.
Great. So you have your scripts, and the jailer should be restraining Antonio in some way.
Who's Antonio?
Antonio.
Love it.
Great, yeah.
My arm is fairly simple.
Yeah.
It's not my arms.
So just grab an arm, maybe. Yeah, that's great. And, all right, let's... You're Solano, and you... I want you to, in particular, Solano, I want you to... support your friend as best you can with your text. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
With your text. So, and go.
Who's this friend? Antonio.
He's a friend of Antonio's. Yeah.
Jailer, look to him. Tell not me of mercy. This is the fool that lends out money gratis. Jailer, look to him.
Give me yet, good Shylock.
I'll have my bond. Speak not against my blood. I have sworn an oath that I will have my bond. Thou callest me a dog before thou hadst a cause, but since I am a dog, beware my fangs. The Duke shall grant me justice, I do wonder, thou naughty jailer, thou art so fond to come abroad with him at his request.
I pray thee hear me speak.
I'll have my bond, I will not hear thee speak. I'll have my bond and therefore speak no more. I'll not be made a soft and dull-eyed fool to shake it the head, relent and sigh and yield. To Christian intercessors, follow not, I'll have no speaking, I will have my bond.
And then you exit.
It's the most impenetrable cur that ever kept with men.
That's curious to me. Did he try very hard? Did he use his text in order to, or did he just not have any text in order to support his friend or uplift his friend in this pretty awful moment?
It's not
your pound of flesh. Right. Maybe, yeah. You know, it just seems like a curious thing for Shakespeare to have that line. But I'm going to give you guys now, or does anybody have any thoughts on the scene first? Any questions about the sense of it or issues? Yeah?
Well, I'm just wondering if his position is the right position to be supported.
Oh, you mean a staging position?
Yeah. Seems like so far away that you're saying support with the text. Like if he was closer and the jailer was going like, then it might be.
That's a great
one. Because then against all three of them Christians.
Yeah, it's very true. And I think, let's move you over. Well, actually, let's keep you here for this time, just for now. This time I'm going to give you guys your Foley. I'm going to give you your roles. Your roles. And so sorry, jailer, you don't get a role. I do want you to listen to how you're described and see if that might affect you. Naughty doesn't mean what we think of as naughty. Naughty is a pretty awful thing to call someone in Shakespeare's day. So feel free to take that in. Feel free to let this Jew, who is a nobody in your culture, call you naughty. Feel free to breathe that in. If that causes you to perhaps let go of your charge for a moment and maybe have a little movement.
Where is naughty?
It's coming in.
Yeah, no, it's in this one. Thou naughty jailer. Yeah. So just whatever that causes you. So Shylock, this is for you. And these have your cues. So everybody now has their cue, Antonio. So you're waiting to hear that. And then you get to speak. And you're waiting as soon as you hear him say that. I want you to say your
every time.
As soon as you hear that,
okay.
You say, yeah. You start to say your line because that's your cue. That's all you know is that that's your cue. But so we're going to listen and see if he's a maybe more active participant in this scene. So, and feel free to, it may get a little crazy, but that's okay. We may have to do it twice. But does everybody understand what's happening?
We're just doing it again.
You're doing it again. And do you see what your cues are?
No.
You don't know necessarily who they come from, but you're waiting for, you start the scene, and you're waiting for that, and then you're waiting for that. Okay. So, let's go to the real
exactly.
Jailer, look to him.
Hear me.
No, tell mommy of mercy. This is the fool that lends out his money gratis. Jailer, look to him.
Hear me yet, good Shylock.
I'll have my bond.
It is the most impenetrable fool.
Speak not against my bond. I have sworn an oath that I will have my bond.
It is the most impenetrable.
Oh, thou caused me dog before thou hadst a cause. But since I am a dog, beware my fangs. The Duke shall grant me justice, I do wonder. Thou naughty jailer, thou art so fond to come abroad with him at his request.
I pray thee hear me speak.
I'll have my bond. I'll have my bond.
And therefore speak no more.
I'll not be made a soft and dull-eyed fool to shake the head, relent, and sigh, and yield to Christian intercessors. Follow not. I'll have no speaking. I will have my bond.
It is the most impenetrable curve.
Thank you. That's really helpful. So, you know, I think they would probably be, they might be used to this by some point, so that those would be kind of, you know, it would then be the, you know, the responsibility of Shylock to overpower the interjections. But at least by the end of the scene, you have a sort of sense of, that's one impenetrable curve.
Yeah.
You know, I've been trying, man. I've been trying to get in there for, thank you for, yeah. That's a great question. I mean, I think it's impossible for us to.
That's the spirit of the culture, entertainment.
Well, I'd say more non-Semitic. To see a Jew in London was like the rarest thing you could imagine. I mean, there was everybody in London. So, I think the main concern with the play Merchant of Venice today is that we can't view it without using the lens of the Holocaust. I mean, and almost every production, or many productions, draw upon that. And any time that Jews in particular have been, you know, mistreated. But for Shakespeare's audience, what we know about it, and actually, in what's another inconceivable thing about this is Shylock would have been like a clown. He would have had like a red wig, essentially. He was really a kind of a ridiculous looking figure and a total pariah. And so, you know, he has these, you know, hath not a Jew eyes, hands, organs, dimensions, senses, you know, fed with the same food. If you prick us, do we not bleed? And if you wrong us, will we not be revenged? If a Christian wrong a Jew, you know, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why revenge? You know, that if somebody actually asks those questions, there's the sort of remarkable, I mean, for a Shakespearean audience to sort of hear that, they've never talked to a Jew. You know, the chances are they've never actually encountered a Jew. So it's a great question. It's one of these plays that we were talking about, how these plays live and whether it behooves us to keep returning to their original intentions or whether... Really, we can't put a Jew on stage in a big red wig, a Jewish character. I mean, and you know, think it's dangerous.
In many countries, they've been banned from the professions, and one of the few left was money.
Exactly.
Christians were not allowed to charge interest, and therefore it was very difficult to get money, except from a Jew who charged interest, and so it was a whole cultural and ultimately racial.
Yeah, it's a.
Could you explain the line about the jailer to come above the jailer?
Yeah, I wonder that thou not a jailer. Which line number is it? Remember?
96.
Yeah. So Shylock, I believe, is saying, the Duke shall grant me justice. You know, he has to. My race doesn't count in the court. You know, I have equal, you know, footing there. And I do. I'm curious that our naughty jailer, who is particularly naughty, that was great. It's remarkable to me that you're so loose in the head that you'd let him walk abroad at his request. I mean, it's such a you know, speaks to, well, shall we call it, I guess our Antonio is white, so we'll say white privilege, that he's allowed to get out of jail and go walk abroad and personally talk to. I mean, how maddening would that be for Shylock, you know, that he's just allowed to.
He's like out on bond or something.
Yeah, he's like, yeah. Except there's been, you know, that gets tricky because the bond is referring to the pound of flesh, but yeah, it's essentially like being out on bond.
It's being critical because the jailer's just letting him walk around.
Yeah, he's just having free reign. What? Yeah, because he's a Christian and I'm a Jew. Or I think it helps to see all the things that could, all the factors that could upset Shylock and get him to this point where we see him, and you know what? He needs to take that pound of flesh. He needs to take that pound of flesh. And I mean, it is such an inhumane thing. And Portia's words about the quality of mercy is not strained. Yeah. Droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven on the place beneath. That those words that Portia says, you know, about mercy, they don't affect Shylock. The people they affect are Antonio. In that courtroom scene, people who are changed by those words are actually Antonio and the Duke. And another big problem with this play is that at the end, when Antonio says, "I'll let him live, I'll let Shylock live," because what happens at the end of the play is that they're trying to get Shylock to relent. Nothing will make him change his mind. Not the quality of mercy speech from Portia will make him change his mind. But then he's about to, she says, okay, you can take the pound of flesh, no less, no more. And he goes in to take it. Tarry a little. You cannot take a jot of blood. So the whole point is that you can't. You can have your pound of flesh, but if there's any blood or maybe like, you know, you sever one of his chest hairs or something like that, then it's forfeit and you die. And so he tries to say, okay, I'll just take the money. And Portia says, no, you don't get the money. You get the pound of flesh or nothing. And I've always thought it'd be interesting if at this moment he goes for it, you know, or he still considers that he, even if I'm going to die, I'm going to take this pound of flesh because this guy, you know, has it coming, or for whatever reason, it would be a terrible moment of tension. If usually that's when the tension breaks, when he realizes that he'd have to die. But if he was still considering it, you know, that would be a sort of terrible moment. But so after this happens, Shylock loses all his money, but Antonio has been changed by this mercy speech and says, well, instead of dying, you can give half of your money to your daughter Jessica and her husband Lorenzo, and the other half to the state, provided that you instantly become a Christian. And so this forced conversion was meant as an act of mercy. And how we would ever perceive that today, you know, forced conversion as merciful is pretty troublesome. But I hope that at least these textual clues can kind of help to humanize a Shylock that's willing to go to incredible, grotesque lengths to get his version of justice. Has anybody seen Merchant of Venice? Do you remember the setting of it? How it was set?
I
different way, that they created new meaning in the ending, but I can't remember what I'm sorry.
No, no, no. And the final act, the whole fifth act, is this kind of charade where there's this business about a ring. You know, this man has just been forced converted to Christianity. And there are actually productions where the Shylock loves it. You know, there have been productions where he whips off his yarmulke at that exact moment, sort of takes the cross around his neck and says, ah, I'm an insider, finally. That's great. You know, which is, I hadn't heard of. But there, you know, I mean, I think for the most part it's considered a, you know, it's an awful thing to observe as an audience to see this. You know, his last words are, you know, let me leave this place, I am not well. And in Laurence Olivier's film, because it's not actually, you know, The Merchant of Venice is actually Antonio. It's not Shylock. You know, he's not even the title character, but in Laurence Olivier's version, he walks off stage and you hear, and he commits suicide. That's like the final thing of Olivier's show. Hmm? Yeah, he agrees to do all this and then actually. Oh yeah, I mean you could certainly see why someone would be drawn to that. I think in general people leave it to the imagination of the audience, but yeah, it is. It really is. I think so. Yeah, I mean it's a fascinating inquiry into justice in particular. And,
it seems to me that from what I remember in terms of my theory, and there was a discussion afterwards about the residential group, you know, about it, which of course I can't remember. But
thank you. Like everybody else is presenting a racist sort of image, or you know, or whether he really was pushing the button, so to speak, on like you were saying, what is justice, what is mercy, what does it do to people, you know? And
I can't put Queen Elizabeth in this because I'd be executed, but I can create a character that's almost outlandish, and yet I'll humanize this person. I'll give him one of the most, you know, pathos-filled monologues in the canon about what it means to be a person.
With the red wig, is he shown super white?
I mean, I don't think it's not the not the American clown image,
but
just.
I mean, the Elizabeth image.
Oh yeah, no, that's a. He wouldn't have been meant to evoke that. More of like a. A ridiculous kind of character. This is some sort of anomaly. Oh no! Sorry. If Shakespeare were to have put the character of Queen Elizabeth, and if he would have done an inquiry into justice, and Queen Elizabeth would have appeared directly, well, it never would have gotten past the council, and he would have been tortured. And, you know, playwrights were tortured for. There's a. Anybody ever see Shakespeare in Love?
Yeah.
There's a character in there who's always poking a rat, John Webster, and he was part of the Shakespeare, you know, the contemporaries of Shakespeare, and one of their contemporaries wrote a play that seemed to be seditious, and he was, you know, he was held in custody by the Privy Council and tortured. So it is. It's fun. The characters that appear in that movie. Also, Marlowe appears in that movie. And the interesting thing about Marlowe is he had a play called The Jew of Malta, which was about, which was incredibly racist. I mean, this Jew was played on everyone's prejudices against Jews. You know, he was an avenging. He was Barabbas. His name was Barabbas. And so you know, this was what this. And it's wonderful how these playwrights played in concert with each other. when Shakespeare would have arrived in London about the time of his first play, the Henry VI plays, there was a play by Marlowe, who was the big shot in town, called Tamburlaine. And it was about this Middle Eastern shepherd who becomes an emperor, essentially. And it's incredibly bombastic. The language has really, got this sort of swagger and quality of realism is not the goal for Marlowe. And what Shakespeare responds with is the Henry VI play is about a king who just wants to be a shepherd, who has a whole monologue about wishing that he could just sit on a molehill and count the hours and take care of his sheep.
And one of the things that we've been talking about all week in this class has been the ability of the actor to take the text and make it mean different things. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about changing the end of the play, then going beyond the text and just saying, okay, whatever Shakespeare wrote, we're not going to go with that.
I didn't mean to imply that. They're very careful. But the meaning at the end, they played it in a way that it had
different implications.
And I also wanted to mention that Ashton, being a repertory theater, it was an anniversary year, and Merchant of Venice had been performed in the very first.
Mm-hmm.
They had this big argument within the company about whether to redo Merchant of Venice for their anniversary. And this one actor was violently opposed to doing it. He was outvoted. He was Jewish, and he said, "Okay, if we're going to do it, I'm going to play Shylock." And he did. And so he played it in a way that really brought out, was kind of the opposite of what you were describing would have been the traditional.
Right.
So far, he really brought out the humanity of Shylock.
Yeah. And that's, it always is a best-selling play, though.
Mm-hmm.
It sells incredibly well, the sort of controversy.
They haven't done it for a number of years.
It's usually not because they can't get people to come to it. But in answer to your question, what is that?
You should just save it for when you have a low budget.
Right. And you want to look edgy. Yeah. But David Garrick was the famous Victorian actor of his day. He was the leading man, played all the major roles. And he rewrote the plays. He definitely inserted, he took the whole thing out of Hamlet, where Hamlet goes to England. He just removed that in order to streamline it and make it quicker. And I'm not sure what he did with Merchant of Venice, but it is actually not uncommon for people to, and like I was saying, that fifth act, all about the rings, which is supposed to be this delightful, the husbands gave away the rings they promised they never would, and so the wives say they'll never sleep with them again. And it's everybody's quite happy, and you're sort of left thinking, how can we, wait, I was just with this guy who was forced to convert to Christianity, and you're trying to make me laugh about, your husband's lack of loyalty about this ring. And so a lot of people will cut that whole act, actually, and just end it.
The BBC did a series called Playing Shakespeare.
Yes.
And one of the characters that they do is it Ben Kingsley?
It's Patrick Stewart and David Suchet.
David Suchet. And one of them is Jewish. David Suchet is Jewish. And he talks about what that role is like for him to play.
Mm-hmm. As a contemporary Jewish man. That's terrific. It's called Playing Shakespeare. Yeah, Instant Watch. You can watch the Royal Shakespeare Company circa when Patrick Stewart still didn't have hair back then, but it was the 70s, I think. But great series.
So were there other playwrights besides Shakespeare at the time that were writing those controversial gender role crosses where the woman was playing a man's part? Of course, it was a man playing
right.
A woman's part playing a man's part. But
yeah, so there were no women on the Elizabethan stage.
And how was that received? I mean, was that
fun? I think Shakespeare certainly went the furthest in terms of, mixed identity, so that when, Viola is it played by a male actor, it's a female character played by a male actor, but Viola dresses as a man, in order to do... Kitty, you played this. Can you explain what, or you know about Viola, doesn't she? So she dresses up as a man in order to serve The Duke. So it's a man playing a woman, playing a man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Judy Dench.
Judy Dench, and does that in the playing Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everybody, so much. Questions about sexuality and elasticity of gender in theater, it's usually the pants role. What does that say to me? And what is it to have young boys playing a woman playing a man? You know, so there are none of those things. The young boy is not the woman or the grown man that they're pretending to be.
Yeah.
It's such a
drag twice removed.
Yeah, drag twice removed, exactly.
We're probably going to miss tomorrow if we don't. If the weather is nice, yeah, we're going to be on a hike, so I'm sorry to miss last. But like I said, I really enjoyed this class.
Yeah, thanks. This has been really great to have you here. Hey, Kyle, man. Cur is like a bad word for a dog.
Okay.
That's
it. Oh, thank you.
You should.
Thank you very much.
You've got the.
Oh, thank you.
You've
very
got
much.
That
itch. It's been Someday. Great to have you here. Are you? When do you leave the village? When do you leave the village?
Saturday.
Well, it's been great to have you here. Thanks for coming.
It's been great to have you here. Hope you take that on the road.
Hey,
this is terrific.
Well, Friday we're gonna do share some monologues. Well, and also the kids are gonna do Pyramus and Thisbe. So it's should be a fun night. If you're around Friday night, 8:30, I think it could be cool.
8:30.
After Vespers.
Where is this from?
This is from Macbeth. Thanks so much for coming, guys. It's so wonderful to have repeats, you know, a sort of intelligent audience. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Curious choice to, let's pick another, margin.
old man